The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
Yes, in fact, Indianapolis, it is May. May is here, the best time of year. I didn't even mean to try to rhyme when I said that, but in fact, the month that we wait all year long for. It is Kurt Vonnegut that once said that the living in Indianapolis was miniature golf 364 days a year and the Indianapolis 500 on the 365th. We've come a long way since then, but the reality is that the wintertime, the gray skies, the cold, we wait through each and every year patiently and work our way through it because we know that eventually spring will blossom. And when it does, you will hear the roar of race cars and you will know that the month of May, the best time of year, is here. In this, in my opinion, the greatest city in the land. jQuery, Mike Thompson, this is Beyond the Bricks from the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. Now, I know that many of you may be listening on a podcast form from around the country. One of the things as an Indianapolis native and resident that I will simply say is that we greatly appreciate you sharing with us the pride, the understanding, and simply the appreciation not just of this event, but of our city. And we are more than willing and grateful to be able to share with you and have everybody be Hoosiers in this, the great month of May. We talked yesterday about the fact that when Danny Sullivan won the Indianapolis 500-mile race, Mike, you had mentioned that one of the things about that race that was, I guess, also special amongst the many different things we talked about is the fact that it was a chance to kind of pay tribute, which we will do more so tonight, to the broadcast career of Jim McKay.
Absolutely. And I wanted to start with tonight, I'm excited that you've taken over the role of Secretary of Rhymes for the show.
That's thank you.
That's good. But no, I wanted to make sure we did. We haven't done a tribute to Jim McKay on the show yet, which I thought would be kind of a cool topic because he's such an important part of the show.
Well, Jim McKay was born in the month of September, actually, not May, but September 24th of 1921 in Philadelphia. But truthfully, it is the city and the state, the city of Baltimore and the state of Maryland, where he really kind of came of age because his family moved to the Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland area when he was a young boy. He was educated throughout in Baltimore, ultimately graduating from college at Loyola of Maryland, which is just on the west side of downtown Baltimore. But like so many of his era and so many of his age group, he would serve in the United States Navy and in the United States military going into World War II. Once he returned from the war, Jim McKay got involved in broadcasting, beginning initially with doing a number of different shows on not ABC, but on CBS. The Verdict Is Yours is one of those that he was involved with. He also was involved with New York Giants football broadcasts back in those days. And while he ultimately would work within CBS, it would be when things would really change for him in 1961 by joining the American Broadcast Corporation, better known as ABC. In that capacity at ABC, he would experience his finest moments, both from the standpoint of broadcast journalism and the compassion shown within it that we will get to, and also as a play-by-play announcer and somebody who oversaw the wide world of sports. And I think a lot of people forget this, Mike, and that is that before the Indianapolis 500 was something that was broadcast in the form that it is today, it was part of that esoteric niche sport offering that was given to us from ABC as part of Wide World of Sports that became a tradition for people, but it was not presented as if it was the World Series or other such things, but rather, hey, we're going to step aside from the stick and ball sports today for Wide World of Sports. And he was a huge part of that.
Yeah, it was a much different time because the early years that the 500 was shown, it was part of Wide World of Sports, and it might be part of, and we'll actually have a clip later on where they're showing part of the 500, then they switch to another event completely. So it was a much different time, and the race would be shown a couple weeks after the race actually happened. So, you know, always being shown in June and things like that. So it was a lot different time as far as how the race was presented before what we call the tape delay era started later on in 1971.
And by the way, obviously Jim McKay within his coverage in television, Mike, you know, I was born September 3rd of 1972. And I remember as far back as I can remember, my mom telling me that, you know, my first days on earth, that she remembers being in the hospital and watching the coverage of the terrible tragedy that took place within the Munich Olympics. And the when you see Jim McKay's coverage of that and having to report on the fatalities involved of the hostages of the Israeli athletes, the compassion that he showed and the professionalism that he showed, any chance that people get to take a look back at everything that went into that, I think really personifies the true definition of Jim McKay professionalism.
100%. I mean, he was unbelievable. And if you haven't seen that, the movie that came out of about a year ago, September 4th, you know, the behind the scenes look at what everything went on at ABC during that, it's absolutely outstanding. I highly recommend that movie. But, you know, Jim McKay is, they didn't cast somebody to play Jim McKay. He's in the movie through archival footage. McKay was so good at what he did in 1972 that basically Walter Cronkite sent him a telegram immediately after, you know, his work covering that terrible tragedy, and, you know, told him what a credit he was to his profession. And when you're getting Walter Cronkite telling you what a great job you did, you know, you did a great job. But you're right. Jim McKay was absolutely incredible during that terrible week.
All of those events that we are talking about right there were a half decade after his debut at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Now, it didn't happen in the form that we know it today in terms of a live, hey, buckle in, we're going to show you 5 hours of coverage of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, but rather within, as we talked about, the window of Wide World of Sports. But Jim McKay introduced himself essentially to IMS in that first telecast that happened for him in 1967.
Good afternoon. I'm Jim McKay speaking to you from one of the most exciting spots at one of the most exciting moments in all the wide world of sports. Behind me, the cars are being wheeled onto the track for the start of the 51st running of the Indianapolis 500-mile Classic. The great Americans are here. Mario Andretti is on the pole. He averaged more than 168 miles an hour in qualification. And then there's Dan Gurney and Gordon Johncock alongside him. There's a great turbine car that you're going to be seeing in just a moment or two here. This is not a one-day story, however. The story of Indy started here more than a month ago.
And, of course, that story in 1967, as he introduced the race, we played it for you on this program, the radio call of the battles of Parnelli Jones. When we talked about Parnelli, who we lost in the offseason between last year's Indianapolis 500 and this year's, that Parnelli Jones had dominated that race, led 171 laps, was leading on lap 196 when suddenly things went away for him. We let you hear earlier how that sounded from the IMS radio network, but Jim McKay let the world know about it on television as well. This is the 1967 finish from ABC Television.
And the crowd now just waiting for victory lane and all that goes with it.
Here comes Jones. Foyt went by just a little ahead, down the back straightaway. There's Foyt.
Let's see, Parnelli must be taking that save fuel sign seriously. He was a lot...
He was
a lot closer.
He ought to be coming by.
Parnelli Jones with this... Roger, I think something's wrong. Something has happened. Something has happened to the lead car. I don't know what it can be. Something's happened. Here he is.
Parnelli Jones is coasting. There's Granatelli.
Cornelli Jones is coasting, coming down.
Possibly could be out of fuel. High confusion in the Granatelli pits. They didn't know whether to run or stay. Now they're running down to the car. There's Andy. Certainly something you wouldn't have suspected. A.J. Foyt just went past and saw it, and there he is waving to his pit crew. Unbelievable chaos here as the lead car, with a little more than three laps to go, has apparently dropped out of the race. Andy Granatelli suffering the most disappointing moment of his lifetime.
They don't seem to be pushing the car down to the pits. Apparently the trouble is more than just being out of fuel.
This car that had no difficulty all through the day, suddenly, without any warning, dropping out with 3.5 laps to go. And on the yellow flag.
That's unbelievable. There's Jones getting out, a very disgusted Jones. And there's the old 98, the car that he would have driven perhaps if it weren't for this car being pushed to the pits.
Strange coincidence there, too. But it looks like A.J. Foyt, and we better start talking about him, is going to be the winner here. And there is Farnelli trying to look as casual as possible, but you know how he's got to feel inside.
Certainly a very disappointing day for Farnelli Jones.
The white flag for A.J. Foyt. Two laps to go before, but now all he has to do is negotiate each of these four turns one more time, and it's all over. A.J. Foyt will win his third Indianapolis 500, a great comeback after last year's disappointing season for him.
Well, he drove a great race. He just stayed in there all day long, grit his teeth, and there's an accident in the front straightaway.
There's two, three, four cars. Where's Foyt? I don't know whether he can get through or not. The Indianapolis 500 in an incredible, thrilling finish.
To an extent, 1967, by the way, Jim McKay, that you heard there narrating what was taking place at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, to some extent, Mike, it does sound like the narration of like a movie theater cinema newsreel, if you will, of telling what happened. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, and don't forget, at the time, the races were also being shown closed circuit in movie theaters across the country. So there was sort of a cinematic, effect or cinematic, portion of the race going on at that time anyway, as well, because of the movie theater aspect. So you're right; it is a bit theatrical with the way it was called in post production.
And of course, because it was part of the Wide World of Sport broadcast, there were times where the Indy 500, believe it or not, was almost treated as, say, an afterthought or something that was just that you pulled out of your hip pocket or that you mixed in with pocket billiards.
So that was the story of practice and qualifications as these drivers and cars were prepared for the greatest race in the world, a fine international field, and for the first time it appeared that a rear-engine car had a chance for victory. Now we'll be back for the exciting start of the Indianapolis 500-mile race shortly. Right now, back to New York City and the World Pocket Billiards Championship and Jim McKay.
Thank you very much, Charlie. Well, we're back here in the main ballroom of the Commodore Hotel in New York City at the World Pocket Billiard Championships, and Joe Balsas, the underdog from Minersville, Pennsylvania, is making a determined run at the title.
Mike, I almost feel like maybe they should have gone to one of the restaurants in Indianapolis for some homemade strawberry dessert, right? Just relaxing, yeah, of a day of pocket billiards and whispering.
Well, he's making a determined run at the title. And what's funny is if you watch that entire thing, they're doing that live, actually, the pocket billiards thing. And they make this like this is the biggest event in the world. And my favorite part of that clip is Charlie Brockman is, we'll be back for the exciting start of the Indianapolis 500, the biggest sporting event in the world. Now pocket billiards, So it's just such a weird dichotomy between the two events,
With the determined competitors.
Yes, very determined competitors are going to be playing. So
that is beautiful. But it does put it into perspective, right?
And, you know, the other thing, Mike, that comes into play that I think a lot of people maybe lose sight of is that oftentimes, you know, those races and the broadcast thereof were not live. And so they could, and, you know, that would come into play, obviously, in later races as well, sometimes even with controversy. But there are times like what we're about to hear, Mike, where you can tell that there's, you know, some advantage to, but very clearly a broadcast illumination of the fact that it was tape delayed and not live.
Yeah, there were, it was definitely not live. I mean, it was all done in post-production. And so they, and it would air weeks later. And so they would be, they'd be talking about, next week we have Le Mans, you know, which we know is in the middle, you know, Father's Day weekend. And they're talking about next week, we're going to show you Le Mans and live. And this week we're showing you the tape from the Indianapolis 500 from a couple weeks ago. So it was definitely a much different time.
And with that, you know, you would have events, for example, like in 1970, when the race coverage, you know, involves Bruce McLaren, but between the time that they're talking about things and then when it actually aired, Bruce McLaren had been fatally injured in a testing crash in the second day of June. And that allowed for a tribute from Jim McKay in the post-production, if you will.
So it was at Indianapolis on Memorial Day. Racing is a sport of excitement, but also of danger. And since last Saturday, the sport has lost one of its finest drivers and most decent personalities. Bruce McLaren of New Zealand, age 32, was killed while testing a car at the Goodwood track in England. He was one of the very best in several areas. As a Formula One driver, I particularly remember him winning a classic race from Phil Hill in the streets of Monte Carlo. In 1966, he teamed with Chris Amon to win the 24 Hours of Le Mans for Henry Ford. And most recently, he and teammate Dennis Hulme, driving McLaren cars, have dominated the Can-Am sports car series to the almost total exclusion of everyone else. When Timmy Mayer, a young teammate of Bruce's, was killed a few years ago, it was McLaren who said, "Life is not only a matter of years. Timmy lived more in his short span than other men do in 70 or 80 years." So it was with Bruce McLaren himself. Still, he will be mourned and missed terribly in the motorsport.
And so again, Formula One star Bruce McLaren passing away 3 days after the Indianapolis 500 in a different part of the world. But the fact that that 500 broadcast would air after that and not live would allow them to intermix the two, as you heard in that tribute. When we come back, more in terms of remembering the great Jim McKay, who passed away. It's hard to believe this now, but it has been nearly 17 years since the loss of Jim McKay, but we've never really properly dove into his contribution to the Indianapolis 500-mile race. That's what we're doing tonight on this episode Beyond the Brick.
In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there, but you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
The Paul Lynn Show and the ABC Wednesday Night Movie will not be seen tonight so that we may bring you the Indianapolis 500 Auto Race.
The subject of this telecast is time, indicated by the ticking of a stopwatch in the pits at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Since the invention of the automobile, men have been racing cars at ever-increasing speeds, fighting a dangerous, noisy battle on the race courses of the world, while the stopwatch ticks at the same rate. How many seconds for a lap? That tells the story. At Indianapolis, the first 500 was won at an average speed of 74 miles an hour. The 13th race was faster than 100 miles per hour, and the 49th in excess of 150. Can a man turn a lap faster than 200 miles per hour? Some think so, and it will have happened if the ticking of the watch stops at exactly 45 seconds for a lap.
And yes, indeed, before the end of the 70s, man would in fact run at 200 miles an hour. Jake Query, along with Mike Thompson, Landon Coons, helping us put it all together. Quality Supply and Tool is the sponsor here of Beyond the Bricks. Tonight, we take a look back at the fabulous career and contribution to the Indianapolis 500-mile race of Jim McKay from inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. And in 1971, the reality is, Mike, once again, we had taken a step in a new direction. You heard it there. No longer was this necessarily, you know, Saturday Wide World of sports coverage intermixed with pocket billiards, but rather the Indianapolis 500-mile race was getting primetime television coverage. Maybe not live, but primetime nonetheless.
That's correct. It went tape delay in 1971, and then things like the Paul Lynn show were now being, you know, bumped off the schedule when there were conflicts because the Indianapolis 500 was taking precedence. So, yes, they went to what's now known as the tape delay era. So they would take a two-hour or a three-hour time slot and put a taped version of the race on that night. Obviously, in Indiana, folks who are from Indiana know all about the, you know, the tape delayed version of the race being on. But nationwide, that was done from 1971 until 1985.
And speaking of Indiana, Chris Schenkel of Indiana was, Mike, he was supposed to be the host, if you will, in 1971 for the telecast. But there was unfortunately an incident that would change that a bit.
That's correct. He was supposed to be the host. Now, Jim McKay was going to do play-by-play, but Chris Schenkel was going to be the overall host and presenter of the broadcast for 1971. But unfortunately, you know, he was pretty badly shaken up in the infamous start of the 1971 race. He was in the pace car along with John Glenn and Tony Holman and the driver, Eldon Palmer, when they had the unfortunate accident. And Chris Schenkel was so shaken up by the whole experience of that he couldn't do it. And so he was no longer involved with the 1971 broadcast.
This is how it sounded, though, at the start of the 1971 race.
All right, Chris, and here they are, poised for the start of the Indianapolis 500 1971. That orange car on the inside on the pole is Peter Revson. The blue car next to him is Mark Donahue. And Bobby Unser on the outside. The green flag is out. They're underway. Going into turn one. Oh, look at the pace car has crashed into a photographer's stand. Mark Donahue has taken the lead. We're on the race. We can't see what has happened down there. The pace car, out of control, crashed into a photographer's stand. People fell out as if a corn crib had been opened, just tumbling down on the track. Chris Schenkel is in the car. Tony Holman is in it. There's the scene. Astronaut John Glenn is in that car with Chris and Tony Holman. A man named Eldon Palmer, a local automobile dealer, was driving the car. Not a professional race driver.
Obviously, in that situation, he was referring, by the way, to not Chris Schenkel, but Chris Economaki at one point. And then that moment where Eldon Palmer came down off of the main straight and then came down the pit road. And, you know, one of the more infamous moments in Indianapolis Motor Speedway history where he simply came in too fast. At one point, it almost looked like he was running at the same speed. He wasn't, but close to it of the starting field at the start of that race. But as we talked about, Chris Schenkel, who was to be the pre-race host, was unavailable for that. There was another Chris, meaning Chris Economaki, legendary writer, Speed Sport News, among others, that would be himself a long-standing broadcaster of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. He was working that race as well. But at one point, Jim McKay thinks that he is sending it down to a report for the legendary Chris Economaki. But if I'm not mistaken, Mike, it was a little known, at least on the national standpoint, broadcaster who was himself a native of Indiana, specifically Indianapolis, and worked here in the Indianapolis market that then made his debut on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway radio, or excuse me, Indianapolis Motor Speedway television coverage for ABC. And I think that guy would later go on to some fame himself, correct?
That's correct. This is actually his national television debut. And not only does he go on to win the race as a car owner, he went on and he had a pretty good career in television. What do you think?
I would say that when you have hosted more primetime television shows than anyone in the history of the American television business, your career went okay. But it began without even recognition of the proper name for none other than David Letterman.
But let's get a report now. Chris Economaki has Mario Andretti.
Mario, what happened?
Well, obviously, there was some oil. I think that was spilled by Krisilov's car. And when we arrived on the scene, Johncock spun in front of me, hit the wall, and ricocheted into my path. And I was trying to kind of pinch it down close so I wouldn't get into him, but I had nothing I could do.
What about the traffic? The faster cars coming up with the slower ones now?
Well, that's normal pace of the race. I mean, this you see everywhere. That's no particular problem.
Thank you very much. Mario Andretti out of the 1971 Indianapolis 500-mile race.
Okay, the green flag is out there racing again. I may have said that was Chris Economaki doing the interview. It was actually Dave Letterman. We have four announcers stationed in the corners for immediate reports like that on the race today.
I think Letterman, Mike, I'm fairly certain on this, he has at times poked fun of himself in terms of that second question from Mario because he kind of wasn't expecting to have a second question. And then the brilliance of simply, what about the traffic, the faster cars and slower cars?
That's right. Well, it's actually obviously a lot harder than it looks. I mean, I was pit reporter for WIBC for the qualifying coverage one time, and I did it one time only. And I asked Marco Andretti just a dreadful question. I mean, it was as bad as that David Letterman question was. I mean, it was legendary bad. And I mean, I dreaded it as soon as I asked the question, and Marco looked at me like I just asked the dumbest question in the history of the world because I had. And so I went to the folks at WIBC afterwards and I said, guess what? I'm not doing that again. Just give me a different assignment for tomorrow. And they did. What was great was they put me in the garage for the next day and I got to interview all the former drivers that I saw. So I'd see a former driver and I'd say, oh, hey, Spike Gelhausen, let's talk about your career, you know, which I'm much more, you know, it was a better suited fit for me than asking a completely ridiculous question.
Listen, it's hard. I don't think sometimes it's hard because someone will answer something briefly and it catches you off guard.
Yep. And well, it was. And I had done pretty well. I had a great interview with Justin Wilson and someone took a picture of the two of us. And I cherish it to this day because it's a great picture. And I don't like pictures of myself, but it's a great picture of me and Justin. And I had a good interview with Ed Carpenter, with Graham Ray Hall, and everything had been going really well. And then the first question to Marco went really well. And then the second one was just an absolute, you know, terrible, you know, just dreadful question. And I went up and I apologized actually afterwards to Marco. I said, Marco, and he said something to me, like laughed it off, like, yeah, that was a stinker or something. Then we had a laugh about it, but you're right. I mean, it's harder than it looks because you have a question in your mind and then like, it's like a balloon. It just pops and it's gone. And then you're like, well, I got to come up with something else, you know? So I'm glad I only did that once.
Well, broadcasting can always present curveballs that make it difficult sometimes. You know, sometimes the days are perfect and other times they are not. For example, the 1973 race is one that seemingly in history you almost don't hear people talk about because there was so much tragedy and just challenge that befell in 1973. And like the IMS radio team in 1973, the television group at ABC had to deal with several delays due to accidents and rain, and then coming back on Wednesday, May 30th of 1973, that race in itself had all kinds of tragedy because of the terrible accident that ultimately would take the life of Swede Savage, a crash at the start of the race that critically injured Salt Walther. There were all kinds of things that went into that race. This is how it sounded in 1973.
Jim Ratzen takes the baseball off the track. He'll shoot. Now, doesn't look like a repeat of last year's start. No, it's a good one. And here they come. Bobby Unser going for the lead. Johnny Rutherford right alongside him. Rutherford down low, but Bobby, there's a terrible crash on the home stretch. There are several cars involved. We can't see the numbers, but it's This is why there's been such a terrible atmosphere of fear here all weekend long. Shame this driver. Waving, he might be on fire, that man. The way he's waving, you can't see an alcohol fire. Those explosions are not cars. Those are the bombs overhead that are normally set off during the start of the race. There is a report already that there may be spectators hurt, not confirmed. The wire fence right here on the straightaway was ripped apart. It was very fortunate that a car did not come into the crowd because one of the standards holding up the wire screen has also been broken in half. Right here at the most crowded part of the grandstand, we almost had an automobile go into the crowd.
There were many people, Mike, a couple of years later after that, because that 73 race was, like I said, just marred by tragedy and bad weather and so many things that went into it. By 1975, when Jim McKay was not on the race call for ABC, there were a lot of people that thought that in some way, shape, or form that he had, whether it be a personal protest or beef, that there was some sort of a reason personally for Jim McKay to miss the 1975 race. But in fact, it was none of that.
Yeah, that's correct. Keith Jackson, actually, the famous, you know, Woe Nelly, football announcer that we know, he actually does the broadcast in 75. And the rumor was that McKay, who, you know, McKay had been very vocal that he loved the Speedway, and that was one of his favorite things to cover. But the rumor was that McKay had become disillusioned with what had happened in 73 and had decided, hey, I don't want to do it anymore. That was completely false. First of all, he came back in 74. So if he was upset with what happened in 73, he wouldn't have come back in 74, but he was back in 74. What happened in 75 was it was his daughter's college graduation, and he promised her, you know, hey, I'll be there for that. And so he went to ABC and said, hey, I need a personal day, basically. And they granted it to him, and he went to his daughter's college graduation. And then he was back in 1976 to do the race again in 1976. He never had any kind of beef with the Speedway. That was a totally false rumor.
And, of course, when it came to describing disappointment or tragedy, for that matter, that happened in 1973, you know, we knew, as we talked about from his broadcast career from an Olympic standpoint, that Jim McKay was the ultimate professional in those situations. And oftentimes, simply the situation of describing the emotion, the disappointment, the despair that can happen for athletes. He had that opportunity in 1976 because it was another race that was plagued by rain. Johnny Rutherford was leading the race. Many think that A.J. Foyt might have been able to surpass Johnny Rutherford in the second half of that race if he had the opportunity to try to get what would have been A.J. Foyt's fourth win. Of course, that would come to him not long after that. But in that race in 1976, as they were sitting there on lap number 102 and A.J. Foyt, the rain is falling, things were gloomy. Here's Jim McKay.
It's raining very hard now. It looks like A.J. Foyt really has very little hope. Let's listen to this announcement. Being escorted by the press, by the photographers, headed towards Victory Lane with his wife, Betty. What a strange, bizarre finish to the 1976 Indianapolis 500. We'll meet him in Victory Lane in a minute.
And it would be a year later where in Victory Lane we would meet A.J. Foyt. The fourth win would indeed come in 1977, and Jim McKay would have a chance to call the historic event.
Black and white checkered flag, and in the pits, the red and white checkered shirts of the Gilmore Foyt team. It's all over. AJ has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Jim McKay, whose voice has become synonymous with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and some of its great events, in particular in the 70s and really in through the 80s as well. We will continue our look back at the icon who was born in Philly, educated in Maryland, and left his imprint here in Indianapolis on this episode of Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Hane has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool with additional locations in Bloomington and Jefferson. Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Hey all, I'm Jamie Lynn Sigler, a mom, actor, and advocate. I know how overwhelming it can be trying to decide which treatment is right for you. I've been there. But you should know you're not alone. You can do this. Start with some research, talk to the community, and most importantly, don't be afraid to ask your doctor questions. You might find results that speak for themselves. That's how I landed on Kesimpta. Ask your doctor if Kesimpta, ofatumumab, could be right for you. You can check out the details at kesimpta.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
We are always so grateful for Quality Supply and Tool for partnering up for Beyond the Bricks. Not the first year they've done so. It is greatly, greatly appreciated. Jake Quarry, along with Mike Thompson, Landon Coons is our engineer as well, as we take a look back at the personalities, the drivers, the stories that make the Indianapolis 500-mile race, in fact, not just the greatest spectacle in racing, but one of the most historic events each and every year in the world of sports. And when we talk about the personalities, it goes beyond Tony Holman that bought the track after the war. It goes beyond Eddie Rickenbacker or Carl Fisher. It goes beyond Roger Penske, those that have been involved in making the venues so fabulous. It goes beyond the drivers. It goes into the personalities and those that it was their job to let the rest of the world know what was happening at 16th and Georgetown in Indianapolis, Indiana. And that includes our subject tonight, Jim McKay, who Mike Thompson, the reality is this, as we have talked about in this particular episode and talked about in other episodes when we've talked about the Indy 500, those races that Jim McKay did oftentimes were, in fact, on tape delay, and they were post-produced, so they could go in and add anecdotes, for example, before it went to air. We gave an example of that with Bruce McLaren passing after the Indianapolis 500, but being able to incorporate tribute to him during the airing of the Indianapolis 500. There were years, though, that kind of created a slippery slope for the television broadcast, because they might have had the luxury, if you will, of knowing of something that was a hot button issue after the fact and then putting it in the broadcast, which might have added a little bit of fuel to the fire, so to speak. We're talking, of course, Mike, about 1981.
Yeah, I think there's really no question. I mean, there are those who believe that Jim McKay and Jackie Stewart kind of threw some gas on the flames of the 1981 controversy. And I think there's evidence to support that. I mean, they knew after the race that there was discussion of a protest and that there was going to be most likely going to be a protest filed against Bobby Unser and against the Penske team for what had happened in the second half of the race by the Patrick team. The Patrick team was going to file the protest. But what happened was, as you said, during that era, the race was being done in post-production. What would typically happen would be Jim McKay and Jackie Stewart would call the start of the race live as it was happening for the first few minutes, and they would call the finish of the race live. And then they would, you know, in the rest of it, they would do all in post-production, basically. So they knew at the time that there was a controversy coming, that it was starting to brew. And so at the time that the infraction happened, the IMS radio network, if you listen to the race on radio, they don't ever even mention it. They don't mention the fact that Bobby Unser passed cars under the yellow or that Mario passed a couple of cars under the yellow as well. I mean, it's never even talked about. But what happens is then the ABC crew, they played it up. I mean, they made a big deal of the fact that Bobby passed these cars. And I mean, it was a violation. There's no question it was a violation. So they made a big deal of the fact that a violation had occurred, and their take on this infraction. There are many who believe that the fact that they played it up as the way they did sort of forced USAC's hand, and that at the end of the night, USAC had to do what they did, which is eventually take the victory away from Bobby Unser and give it to Mario. Because at that point, you can't penalize. If you could have penalized Bobby Unser during the race, that would have obviously been the best case scenario for what happened, because he could have gotten a chance to get the race win back. It would have not gone to the courts and all the things that ended up happening because of that. But that's what ended up happening, is that a lot of people believe that it forced USAC's hand because of what happened on the telecast.
Almost a damned if you do, damned if you don't proposition in terms of working the post-race production of it, because you know, as you go in, to your point, to the booth, that it's something that needs to be pointed out. This is how it sounded after the fact when they suddenly, quote, became aware of what was happening. The 1981 television tape delay broadcast.
Bobby out again, and Bobby going out very past a car. What's he doing? He's passed about half a dozen cars.
Oh, James, that's
under the yellow. You can't do that.
That is a no-no. He has accelerated probably in the haste of leaving the pit lane. He's certainly overtaken these other cars. I'm not sure why he did that. I know that you're certainly not supposed to do it. The regulations say that under yellow flag conditions, you must not pass any other cars, and that certainly has been the case here. He certainly passed other cars. Right now, of course, they're under the yellow. There you see him in the blue and red car there, blue and yellow car.
But you're supposed to blend into the traffic, right? Let's see if he did that at all.
Yes, you are supposed to leave that pit lane, and if you have to pass a car for other reasons, it's for blending purposes. But certainly he has accelerated all the way down below the double yellow line there and simply overtaken a lot of cars there. I'm sure Bobby must know the regulations. I'm sure he knew what he was doing. Whether his mind was somewhere else, I can't say, obviously. But he shouldn't, in my opinion, have passed these other cars, Jim.
That is, in fact, Jackie Stewart, not Mrs. Doubtfire, that was doing the broadcast with Jim McKay in 1981. Now, that would lead to, in 1982, Jim McKay and then Sam Posey, who, of course, was part of the ABC broadcast crew, talking about, I guess, a bit of a mess in 1982, because in 1981 you had that controversy. Then 1982, the race begins, and, well, you know what happened. Kevin Cogan got a little bit loose. Things got squirrely. Here's how it sounded.
Watch the starter's platform on the left there. It's still not out. They appear to be in pretty good order in the first five or six rows at any rate. A little bit ragged towards the back. And look out, a crash before the start of the race. It was Kevin Cogan from the middle of the first row, suddenly taking a hard left turn. Tires flying. How in the world could this have happened?
Absolutely no idea, Jim. That's one of the most extraordinary things I've ever seen. Remember, they were going about 130-140 miles an hour when that started, but there is just no explanation, and now one of the favorites is totally out of the race.
And Dale Whittington's car is up against the wall. That's one of the three Whittington brothers. Number 40 you saw there was Mario Andretti. There is the number four car of Kevin Cogan that appeared to start it all.
And, of course, that started the 1982 race that led to the legendary interviews from Chris Economaki with A.J. Foyt and Mario Andretti. It would be an ugly start to the race, but they still had the opportunity to call one of the great finishes in IMS history.
Rick
We talked about the fact that the 1982 Indianapolis 500, Mike, a big part of what led to the conversation about Jim McKay tonight, which has been a great show, and very much appreciate you pulling all the audio about Jim McKay. You know, he had another great moment on his swan song in 1985, a year later, when he was able to call that spin to win for Danny Sullivan. Hard to believe that was 40 years ago, but quite the impact from Jim McKay.
Incredible career, and I'm glad we got to shout out his career, because he's really an important part of Indianapolis 500 history for a lot of us.
For so many people, there are certain voices that when they hear it, it reminds them of the race. For so many people, one of those voices belonged to Jim McKay. For Mike Thompson, Lane and Goons, I'm Jake Query. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
The future of Harlem rests in your hands.
The MGM Plus original series, Godfather of Harlem, returns. Starring Academy Award winner Forrest Whitaker.
There's a new kid in town.
And Rome Flynn as Frank Lucas.
I'm the boss of me.
Critics rave about the rare gangster epic.
My father's planning a war.
Praising it as a great prestige drama.
Nobody plays Frank Lucas.
We will go to war.
Godfather of Harlem. Watch now, only on MGM Plus.
El sarampión es una enfermedad seria y altamente contagiosa. De acuerdo a los CDC, uno de cada cinco enfermos de sarampión en los Estados Unidos serán hospitalizados y corren el riesgo de desarrollar discapacidades de por vida. Este año se ha detectado un caso de sarampión en una escuela preparatoria al sur de la Florida. Para mejor protección, tus hijos necesitan dos dosis de la vacuna MMR administrable desde los 12 meses a 6 años de edad. Vacunación gratuita está disponible mediante el Departamento de Salud del Condado de Orange. Protege a tus hijos contra el sarampión. Visita protectyourchildnow.net.